The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Is there anything that you don't believe in?
Sure there is. There's, Okay, well, what about you? If not Bigfoot or zombies or ghosts, what do you believe in?
I believe in the everyday magic of life. I mean, things that I can see and touch, like, the green shoots that pop through the snow in February, or the Flatiron Building, or the way that I feel when I hear Coltrane. It's...
I can appreciate the everyday, but why not live in the possible? The world just doesn't have as many mysteries anymore. There's no new continents to explore. There's no more deepest, darkest Africa. Everything's all mapped out by satellites and sonar, yet still, people reach for the unknown. It's what makes us grow. Coltrane wouldn't have had that saxophone if Antoine Sax hadn't imagined it. Isn't that what separates us from, say, moonshine?
Well, you know, there is one inexplicable, mysterious phenomenon that I do believe in still.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
We have a bit of an unusual presentation for you today. In part inspired by atheist Richard Dawkins' recent statement that he considers himself to be a cultural Christian. That has sparked a subsequent controversy that challenges fundamental assumptions about both atheism and faith-based belief. But to address the question in our show opener today, that is there anything that I don't believe in? I would answer yes. There are a lot of things I don't believe in, and among the many things I don't believe in is this: atheism. You know, atheism is a little difficult to believe in. In fact, I would go so far as to say that atheism isn't a thing. It's not a philosophy that prescribes a way of living. Remember that without theists, the concept of atheism might never have arisen. And there's a perfect example of the law of causality, which is so central to all religious belief and to secular and rational moral belief as well. I think that too many self-described or labeled atheists are being falsely criticized and maligned, sadly, by religious groups and individuals who equate atheism with some kind of evil moral code or with no moral code at all. Well, we're going to test those assumptions about atheists by doing something very unusual and unique regarding that theme. Today's show is all about belief and non-belief, about theism and atheism, about God, about the devil, about culture and Christianity, about existence and non-existence, about cause and first cause, and every voice that you will hear discussing these issues on today's show, my own included, and in all of our selected audio bites today, is the voice of someone who self-identifies as atheist, insofar that they do not accept the concept of deity. God and Christianity, however, may be an entirely different matter. And if that sounds a little contradictory, maybe it will all start making a bit more sense right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, to make it clear from the outset of today's show, let me offer my personal definition of God, as I have done on several shows past. God is the name that we give to the Supreme Being. And by Supreme Being, I mean all that exists, existence itself, the being of all, as opposed to the not being of anything. But I do not interpret God as being a deity. So does that make me an atheist? Funk and Wagnalls defines atheism as quote, the belief that there is no God, end quote. So how does that definition reconcile with my own description of God as the name given to the supreme being, but not as a being that takes the form of a deity? Well, it doesn't. Moreover, the dictionary definition defines atheism as a belief, essentially putting atheism in the same religious category as theism. So I thought I'd get a few basic simple definitions out of the way in case I overlook that task later in the show. And these are all from Funk and Wagnall, some of the simplest definitions we use in our day-to-day conversations about these words. Theism, belief in the existence of God, a god, or gods. 2. Belief in a personal God as creator and supreme ruler of the universe who transcends his creation but works in and through it in revealing himself to men. 3. Belief in one God, monotheism. End quote. Now that's an interesting contrast because definition 3 says only one God, definition 1 says it could be several gods. Now here's Funk and Wagnall's definition of God, and they spell it two different ways. Here's the definition of the word God, spelt with a lowercase g. 1. One of the various beings, usually male, in mythology, primitive religions, etc., conceived of as immortal, as in embodying a particular quality of having special powers over some phase of life. 2. A statue, image, or symbol of such a being. And 3. Any person or thing much loved. Now, that's really interesting. I would not have thought of a couple of those, and I certainly wouldn't consider a statue itself as being a god. But here's a definition of God with a capital G. Quote, in monotheism, the ruler of life and the universe, end quote. Then we move to the word deity. Quote, 1. A god, goddess, or divine person. 2. Divine nature or status, godhead, divinity, God, with a capital G. So in other words, that's kind of God as a person. Then this is interesting, and here's the definition of deism. 1. Belief in the existence of a personal God based solely on the testimony of reason. And 2. Belief that God created the world subject to natural laws, but takes no interest, end quote. Now, I don't know what to make of that contradictory rationalization, but it appears that Funk and Wagnall's definitions of deity and deism have very little to do with each other. And you know, it sounds a lot like St. Thomas Aquinas' 5 ways to prove the existence of God that we'll be touching on a little later in the show today. A couple more definitions. Secular, 1, of this world or the present life. Temporal, worldly, distinguished from spiritual. 2, not under the control of the church. Civil. 3, not concerned with religion, not sacred. 4, not bound by monastic vows. And secularism is, quote, 1, the belief that morality should be determined without reference to religious systems, and 2, the view that religion should not be introduced into public education or civil affairs, end quote. Now, I have found that many religious people confuse the words secular and secularism with some kind of variant of atheism. They assume that because the secular is, quote-unquote, not concerned with religion, that the secular is against religion, and that because the secular is, quote-unquote, distinguished from the spiritual, that the secular is against the spiritual. But that's simply not so. That's not what the word secular ever meant in my understanding, but I see so many religious people, particularly Christians, use it as if it were the same word as atheist, and also that it means something, you know, very ungodlike and opposed to any sort of deity. It has nothing to do with that. A secularist could be completely religious. The common mistake that most religious people make about atheists is that atheists, because they do not believe in a literal deity or in an afterlife, are not capable of sharing similar values of life, morality, and ethics on which religion has held some kind of spiritual monopoly for quite a while now. So, let's find out a little more about these godless atheists and their religion, shall we? And without much further ado, let's begin today's conversation with 2 atheist reactions to atheist Richard Dawkins considering himself a cultural Christian. On this side of our upcoming bumper, Sargon of Akkad from his April 9th commentary, in which he suggests that Christianity is dying of its own accord, not because of atheistic influences. While on the return side of the bumper, from April 4th, Romanian TV, in which he attempts to reconcile Dawkins' praise of Christianity with his lack of belief in God.
Recently, Richard Dawkins, one of the famous four horsemen of the New Atheist movement, was interviewed on a radio station called LBC and admitted to being a cultural Christian. This made some waves online, even though this wasn't actually the first time Dawkins has said as much. However, one may remember that the New Atheists were very active in the late 1990s and early 2000s, vigorously debating Christians and doing whatever they were able in order to impose the imperial truth on a society in which Christianity had already begun to slowly die. It isn't that the New Atheists killed Christianity. Instead, they spent a great deal of energy beating a dying horse. New Atheism itself fizzled out when it turned out that there was no great Christian dragon left to slay, and out of its ashes rose the phoenix of social justice. The New Atheists, with their dogmatic insistence on reason and science, cleared the path for the rational restructuring of society along gender, sex, and racial lines, what we now call woke ideology. After learning that Ramadan was being celebrated publicly in London, Dawkins expressed his horror that a religion other than Christianity was being promoted in Britain, and explained his affinity for the Christian religion, which he describes as a fundamentally decent religion.
Well, I must say I was slightly horrified to hear that Ramadan is being promoted instead. I do think that we are culturally a Christian country. I call myself a cultural Christian. I'm not a believer. But there's a distinction between being a believing Christian and being a cultural Christian. And so, you know, I love hymns and Christmas carols, and I sort of feel at home in the Christian ethos. I feel that we are a Christian country in that sense. It's true that statistically the number of people who actually believe in Christianity is going down, and I'm happy with that. But I would not be happy if, for example, we lost all our cathedrals and our beautiful parish churches. So I count myself a cultural Christian. I think it would matter if we, certainly if we substituted any alternative religion, that would be truly dreadful.
Well, which brings me to my supplementary point, which is that, as we know, church attendance is plummeting, but the erection of mosques across Europe, I think 6,000 are under construction, and there are many more, I mean, are being planned. So do you regard that as a problem? Do you think that matters?
Yes, I do, really. I mean, I have to choose my words carefully. I mean, if I had to choose between Christianity and Islam, I'd choose Christianity every single time. I mean, it seems to me to be a fundamentally decent religion, in a way that I think Islam is not.
I would also not be happy if we lost our beautiful cathedrals and parish churches to be converted into mosques. But why is it that this is the dynamic that we are presented with? The answer, of course, is a fundamental imbalance in belief. Muslims believe in Islam and believe it is their duty to pay to have mosques constructed, and they actually take the time to attend them. In Britain, at least, church attendance has never been lower, and we do not spend the time and money on our religion in the same way because we don't really have one anymore. If a church cannot be maintained, it will be sold, mostly converted into housing, but also converted into a mosque. What Dawkins is asking for is to have the consequences of religion without the mechanism of it, to have the believers without the belief. Naturally, this contradiction cannot hold, and without sincere belief, there will be no believers. This fact seems to have become apparent in the years after the New Atheists, where the consequences of killing Christianity are bearing their poisoned fruit. Social breakdown, a failure of personal ethics, a lack of moral authority, the death of the desire to build things which are beautiful, and the creation of a vacuum which foreign religions will happily fill with their true believers. I wonder if Dawkins ever wonders if, in fact, he did the right thing. He may not believe that Christianity is true, whatever that is supposed to mean when dealing with matters of faith, but perhaps the pleasant untruth had virtues that were not immediately obvious, and killing off the ailing religion was perhaps a mistake. Hitchens might have felt that there was something spiritually wrong with the death of a religion, some kind of irreversible loss, and perhaps thought that there were some boundaries that, for whatever reason, just shouldn't be crossed, even for the dogmatic materialist. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, another member of the Church of New Atheism, in the early 2000s, after escaping Islam, last year announced her conversion to Christianity for precisely the reason that Dawkins is now lamenting its decline. She says, quote, "I have come to realize that Bertrand Russell and my atheist friends failed to see the wood for the trees. The wood is the civilization built on the Judeo-Christian tradition. It is the story of the West, warts and all. Russell's critique of those contradictions in the Christian doctrine is serious, but it is also too narrow in scope. To me, though, this feels slightly too consequentialist to be of any real use." Ali explains that without religion, she felt that her life had lost purpose, and so to give herself guidance and help bolster the West, she has embraced Christianity. But can we actually say that this is indicative of sincere belief? I'm afraid that I think it's not, even if it's a step in the right direction. If you're wondering, I am myself still an atheist, but maybe somewhat regretfully. I think that any religious profession should be underpinned by a sincere conviction, and not a utilitarian calculus. I am not a Christian, but I am a supporter of Christianity.
Richard Dawkins is one of the people that was instrumental in my journey towards atheism. I remember growing up listening to his videos, and he was making a lot of sense. And it's interesting to see that Richard Dawkins is now coming back to religion, especially Christianity. Now, he doesn't believe in God. He still thinks that it's superstition, but he does understand that the role of religion isn't just to talk to people about the supernatural. It isn't just to explain things to people that they themselves do not know. Like, for instance, what comes after death, right? Like, religion comes in, and this is what all religions do. They come in and they tell you, well, actually, there's an afterlife, and here's what happens after you die. But the purpose of religion is more than that. The purpose of religion is to also create a community, and it also offers moral guidance to people. I remember atheists used to say, well, yeah, but like without religion, you can still be a moral person, which is true to some extent. But there are certain questions that are difficult to answer. For instance, is it okay if a person identifies as the opposite gender and wants to be placed in a female prison? Do children belong to their parents? Like you will see that a lot of left-leaning individuals will have a very difficult time answering this question, right? There are even politicians that say, no, children do not belong to their parents, children belong to the community. Which is interesting, because the moment the child does something bad, like if he breaks a window, the parents are the ones that are responsible, but at the same time, they do not want to give the parent the authority to educate their child properly in order to make sure that doesn't happen, right? So like, this is one example, but if you ask them, can children consent? Well, the most liberal atheists that grew up in a religious household, so they still have like the principles from their parents that were religious, will say, no, of course not, children cannot consent. But if you ask them the follow-up question, can children consent to changing their gender without their parents knowing and with the teachers encouraging it, well, you will see that now the liberal goes like, well, actually. So my point is that religion does offer, besides the supernatural, a sense of belonging, a sense of community. It increases happiness for people. And without that, people will just create their own stuff.
And that's exactly what they do, with or without a religious backing or environment. You know, I can't help but feel that in choosing Christianity over Islam, Dawkins was making a kind of a political voter's move. You know, voting for the lesser of two evils. Evils in the sense that he does not actually believe in either doctrine to be true, And this is exactly what so many people do in politics, the voters. They hate all of their political choices, so they either don't vote or they vote for the lesser evil of a given number of parties. Within the commentaries of both analysts, Argan of Akkad and Romanian TV, rest a lot of assumptions that I suspect might not be so. To suggest that Dawkins wants consequences of religion without the belief on which it is based presumes that the desired consequences even have anything to do with the religion in question in the first place. I think that the so-called consequences had more to do with living in a rational, secular society than with Christianity per se. Christianity has been the religion to most align itself with rational principles, but as a constantly evolving movement, is itself susceptible to woke ideologies and has adopted and rejected various philosophies and ideas from completely non-religious sources throughout its history. Whereas Christianity and Christ is a narrative, a story, morality originates through reason applied to reality and with the standard of life representing the good and the standard of death representing the evil. Romanian TV's assertion that without religion you can still be moral, but that leaves many questions difficult to answer, I thought was a bit presumptuous. Mind you, in making that statement, he explicitly was speaking about left-leaning individuals, to whom all questions are apparently difficult to answer. But even so, he makes a giant leap in logic by assuming that a morality without a religious base is incapable of correctly regarding parents as the guardians of their children, or that children cannot consent. These are purely rational conclusions based on a morality of freedom and consent, not on any belief in a deity or any other religious narratives and stories. Now, I know this might sound hard to believe, but I have yet to hear any of the many, many Christian bloggers and commentators that I listen to explicitly define or describe what Christianity is and what it is not, and what Christians are and what they aren't, in terms of the ideas and values and principles upon which Christianity is supposedly founded. In fact, even trying to find out what Christianity was and stood for was a much more difficult task than I had ever imagined, and I've got a lot of religious resources from which to draw, including an amazing encyclopedia of who's who in the Bible. But the best way that I can describe Christianity is as a personality cult, surrounding the historical figure of Jesus Christ. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is an entirely separate discussion. So, I consulted my Universal World Reference Encyclopedia, which my parents bought for me when I was very, very young, like preschool. And in there I looked up the term Christian, and here's what it says. Quote, "The universally used designation of the followers of Jesus Christ. According to Acts 2:26, it was first applied to the members of the Church of Antioch. It has been argued that the word originated in Rome, but there is evidence that the form was adopted by Greek writers of a fairly early date. The word was sometimes written Christianos, from its resemblance to Christos, the good, and this form seems to have been favorably received by some Christian writers. The term was probably not of Christian origin, since Christians called each other brethren, disciples, or saints, nor of Jewish origin, for Jews called Christians Nazarenes. It is commonly believed that the word originated among the pagans as a convenient name for a new sect." And then there's this from Wikipedia under the heading actually of Christian philosophy, which was surprising. Quote, "includes all philosophy carried out by Christians or in relation to the religion of Christianity." So it's not even one thing. "Christian philosophy emerged with the aim of reconciling science and faith, starting from a natural, rational explanation with the help of Christian revelation. Several thinkers, such as Origen of Alexandria and Augustine, believed that there was a harmonious relationship between science and faith. Others, such as Tertullian, claimed that there was a contradiction, and others tried to differentiate them. There are scholars who question the existence of a Christian philosophy itself. These claim that there's no originality in Christian thought, and its concepts and ideas are inherited from Greek philosophy. Thus, Christian philosophy would protect philosophical thought, which would already be definitively elaborated by Greek philosophy. However, Bonar and Gilson claim that Christian philosophy is not a simple repetition of ancient philosophy, although they owe to Greek science the knowledge developed by Plato, Aristotle, and the Neoplatonists. They even claim that in Christian philosophy, Greek culture survives in organic form. The philosophic starting point of Christian philosophy is logic, not excluding Christian theology, although there is a relationship between theological doctrines and philosophical reflection in Christian philosophy, its reflections are strictly rational. On this way of seeing the two disciplines, if at least one of the premises of an argument is derived from revelation, the argument falls in the domain of theology. Otherwise, it falls into philosophy's domain. That actually makes sense. Fundamentally, Christian philosophical ideals are to make religious convictions rationally evident through natural reason. The Christian philosopher's attitude is determined by faith in matters relating to cosmology and everyday life. Unlike the secular philosopher, the Christian philosopher seeks conditions for the identification of eternal truth being characterized by religiosity. There is criticism of Christian philosophy because the Christian religion is hegemonic at this time and centralizes the elaboration of all values. The coexistence of philosophy and religion is questioned, as philosophy itself is critical, while religion is founded on revelation and established dogmas. End quote. Well, that last statement certainly goes a long way towards explaining why it is difficult to identify Christian philosophy as such. So that's our very brief overview of Christianity, but what about God? To address that issue, are the voices of more self-described atheists on this side of our bumper, Constantin Kissin, in conversation about the rise of religion with John Anderson on his April 29, 2022 show, and on the return side of the bumper from the February 19, 24 edition of Modern Wisdom, hosted by Chris Williamson, in conversation with Eric Weinstein, who describes himself as an atheist who prays.
You recently wrote an article called The Age of Religion is Upon Us. Now, many of us would have thought that, particularly here in Britain, the age of religion has gone. But your argument is that the religious impulse for meaning in people is being filled by other things. Can you just fill us in on your thinking around this sort of what might be called God void in people in our allegedly secular age, and where you think that might be going?
Well, it's an extremely unoriginal thought, John, to suggest that the God-shaped void in all of us, it gets filled by other things when it's not filled by God. And, you know, I'm a non-believer myself. I'm agnostic, I think. Probably it's a word that doesn't accurately describe how I think about these things, but I'm a non-believer. I don't go to church. I don't think there's a bearded man in the sky who sits and judges all of us individually and wants Israel and Palestine to be a multi-millennium conflict. I'm not convinced of that way of looking at the world. But at the same time, as I say, it's an unoriginal observation to note that when people lack some kind of structure to explain the things that we're unable to explain, we look for other things. And I see it particularly in the political realm, where some of the ideas we've talked about, like wokeness and a certain type of thinking about things, it's an ideology based on faith alone. And so we're moving in that direction on that side. And of course, on the other side, you now start to see in certain pockets of the right, a new ideology and religious ideology emerging as well, which is having had all our faith in the mainstream destroyed by lots of lies and misrepresentations and being called names for doing perfectly reasonable things and having perfectly reasonable opinions. There is now a very primitive religious, I almost feel like it's insulting to organized religion to suggest that that is a religious instinct. But if you think about primitive ways of thinking about spirituality and religion, there are ways to explain things that we lack the scientific and technological explanation for at the time. So if you're a person living 50,000 years ago and water starts falling from the sky, well, it happens, but it is quite an impactful thing on your life. And you have no explanation of the formation of clouds and droplets and whatever. So you go, well, the angry man in the sky is punishing me for whatever. And I think you're starting to see now, particularly in pockets of the online sort of anti-establishment right, the belief in an overarching global conspiratorial forces that are taking over the world, and they are punishing the West for its decadence and the embracing of wokeness. And really what COVID was all about was about government taking control of your life. And by the way, some governments tried. I just don't see that as a global conspiracy. But this global conspiratorial explanation, it is actually a very primitive religious way of looking at things. And I think that is a big part of what's happening on all sides of the political spectrum as we move further away from one way of looking at things that is imposed on us by society and by religion. We are opening ourselves up to a lot of cults. And I'm very aware of that because religion is a very powerful thing and it can be used for good. But it can also be used for evil. And I think in this instance, all of these cults are very, very dangerous.
There is this very funny sort of Newton's law that I also talk about with Ben Shapiro and Sam Harris, that Ben Shapiro is always talking about the need for reason in areas which seem normative, because he doesn't want to make an appeal to religious norms so much because he's known to be an Orthodox Jew, whereas Sam Harris is always talking about spirituality and morality because he's an atheist who is suspected of not having a moral code because it doesn't come from a god.
I was reflecting on the odd horseshoe that we've seen from people like Douglas Murray and Sam Harris, who were very critical of religion, still are, to a large degree. But especially, 20 years ago, kind of breaking down a lot of these walls, being involved in being skeptical about the role of it. And yet, there's now almost a return to nostalgia for a grand narrative that unifies everybody. There's a concern about what has come in its place. Is it wokeism? Is it Trumpism? Is it?
How do you see that?
It's too trite to say baby in bathwater. I just think that sometimes you don't know better the devil you know in some ways.
I have a different take on it, but that's interesting. Okay. So one of my riffs is that if you look at the Declaration of Independence, the language says we hold these truths to be self-evident. You have to say because. You have to say we are not going into an infinite sequence of why statements. And by saying we hold these truths to be self-evident, you're saying you may not hold them to be self-evident. Bugger off. We hold these truths to be self-evident. If you can't hold these truths to be self-evident,
it's exclusionary in some way.
Absolutely. And so very often when you imagine that you're going to put everything on reason, anybody who's had an intelligent child knows, why, Daddy? Why is that? Well, why is that? And eventually it's—
infinite regret.
Well, I joke with my son and I say, either the parent eventually says because, or you end up as a theoretical physicist, because that's things terminate. You have to have an organizing principle that scales. And, Sam's mistake is not understanding that even if Sam Harris can be a moral and ethical, somewhat rational human being at times, on his best day, take Sam Harris as a reasonable, rational, moral human being. You can't scale that. It doesn't scale. That's a big difference between saying it's impossible for an individual and saying it's impossible for a society. The next part of that, part of the document is that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator. You have to make a reference to ground assumption where you are not going to go below. And if you don't do that, you end up in infinite regress.
That's your because.
Yeah. If I ask you as a computer, divide 1 by 3 to infinite precision. Give me the answer. It'll say 0.333333, and it'll blow up. It's called a resource leak. You can't allow these infinite recursions seeking truth. And as a result of that, we didn't understand the load-bearing nature of religion in the atheist movement. Now, I say we, that was never my problem. I'm an atheist who prays, as I've said. And people get very confused. Well, who do you pray to? And what do you mean? And your brain knows how to pray. Your brain knows how to believe in a God, whether there is a God or there is no God.
Well, how important is belief?
I don't know. But I've never met an atheist who never believes. And I've never met a religious person who always believes. Humans flit in and out of belief and non-belief. It is the nature of our beast. And as a result of that, you know, I feel like we're just not honest. If you claim as an atheist that you never entertain the idea of an almighty and a creator, I don't believe you. And if you're a religious person who says, like, my belief in my Lord is 100%, I was like, nope.
There's a line from George Janko where he says, every man knows God when he's at his lowest place.
Okay. The foxhole.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was 5 years old and I was scared to sleep alone on darker nights, I thought the monsters would all try to eat me if they saw my open eyes. My mother taught me praying to my maker would send angels to my aid. As a child, I learned that messages to heaven were the way to keep me safe. Throw me in the waves. Throw me in the ocean, I've been hopeless in this boat with all my shame. Throw me in the waves. And if I'm swallowed by a monster, I know God's here and I'll make it out okay. Then everything was wonderful and marvelous with God paving the way. I pushed myself to follow every message and commandment that He gave. No one seemed to notice as my mental health slowly withered away. Cause if you feel like you are trapped inside yourself, it has to be a test of faith. So throw me in the waves. Throw me in the ocean, I've been hopeless in this boat with all my shame. Throw me in the waves. And if I'm swallowed by a monster, I know God's here and I'll make it out okay. I'm 22 years old and I'm still scared to sleep alone on darker nights. Cause when I needed God the most, He left me out for dead. He left my side. Maybe He's just a thing our parents made because it helps them to feel safe. But if He's real, one day I'll get to meet Him, then I know just what I'll say. Throw me in the waves. I was swallowed by the monster and you disappeared. You don't deserve your place. So throw me in the waves. And I'd rather drown and die than have to spend all of my life with misplaced faith.
Wow. You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And I'd rather drown and die than have to live with misplaced faith. That's a powerful statement expressed in a song of the same name, Misplaced Faith, written and performed by LeGrand, whose music has been featured on at least two of our previous Music That's Just Right broadcasts. And of course, religious expression and music go hand in hand, and we'll be learning more about that in the moments ahead. But what really caught my attention was the comment by Eric Weinstein on the subject of infinite regress. It seems to me that this principle, this concept, speaks to the heart of all beliefs in God and deity. After all, in a world of causality, you have to have a first cause, don't you? You have to say because. We are not going to go into an infinite sequence of why statements, says Weinstein. You have to make a reference to ground on the assumption, or you end up in infinite regress. You can't allow these infinite incursions into seeking truth. End quote. What Weinstein is referring to and seeing as a necessity is a first cause, which is a necessity in human affairs, but which has no bearing to explaining the existence of existence.
Before the Big Bang,
there was no up, there was no down, there was no side to side, there was no light, there was no dark, nor shape of any kind. There were no stars or planet Mars or protons to collide. There was no up, there was no down, there was no side to side. And furthermore, to underscore this total lacking state, there was no here, there was no there, because there was no space. And in this endless void, which can't be thought of as a place, there was no time, and so no passing minutes, hours, days. Of all the paradoxes that belabor common sense, I think this one's the greatest, this time before events. Because how did we get from nothing to infinitely dense, from immeasurably small to inconceivably immense? But before we get unmoored from the question at the start, let's take a breath and marvel at when math becomes an art. Because we don't have to understand it to know there was a time when there was no up, there was no down, there was no side to side.
What a great rhyme. And the number of contradictions described within its prose actually speak to a greater truth. That there never was a Big Bang in the sense of creating something out of nothing, but that didn't stop people from attempting to describe and define a first cause in any event. And one of those people was St. Thomas Aquinas, whose Five Ways to Prove the Existence of God was first featured on our show back on October 4th, 2018, wherein we heard Oxford University's Dr. Daniel Robinson recite verbatim from Thomas Aquinas' proof. And here's the essence of that. I've kind of cut it down a bit, but it's still from the words of St. Thomas Aquinas. And this is his five ways to prove the existence of God. Number one, the prime mover for celestial dynamics. The method that proceeds from the point of view of motion. Everything that is moved by something that actually exists. But this could not go on into infinity because this would require a first mover, moved by nothing. And this all men know as God. Number two, the nature of the efficient cause. There is always a chain of causes, but if it went back infinitely, we must propose some first efficient cause. If the chain were to go back infinitely, there would be no first cause. Hence, we must predispose some first efficient cause, which I'll call God. Number three, the nature of possible and necessary. If nothing existed, it would be impossible for anything to begin, and there would now be nothing existing, which is admittedly false. But there must necessarily be all existent being, which I'll call God. As nothing can come from nothing and there are many things, there must be something that was the source of the first thing. Number four, from the degrees that are found in things. For there is found greater and lesser degrees of goodness, truth, and nobility, and the like. There exists, therefore, something that is the truest, and the best, and the most noble, and in consequence, the greatest being. And this we call God. Number five, the natural order itself. Some things which lack reason, such as natural bodies, are operated in accordance with a plan. Once it is clear that they do not arrive at a result by chance, but because of purpose, therefore there is something intelligent by which all natural things are arranged in accordance with a plan. And this we call God. End quote. Now, of course, Aquinas' proofs were subject to powerful religious criticism over the years. Among the arguments was that if one could prove, quote-unquote, the existence of God, then there would be no need for faith. Well, you cannot prove existence either, since existence cannot be subject to proof without also being subject to being possibly disproven, which would result in a contradiction. I mean, if someone could prove that existence did not exist, then it only follows that both the person who proved it and his or her proof would similarly not exist. You see the point? Now, prepare yourselves for one of the most engaging and unusual discussions you'll ever hear about religion. again as discussed by two self-described atheists, Chris Williamson and Eric Weinstein, and then open your minds to the possibility that some atheists might be more religious than the true believing theists themselves. I'll leave that one for you to decide, but get ready for a fun ride.
The world is confusing. It's hard to make sense. We don't know what's real. We don't know what isn't. We don't know if we can trust the information that we're getting that's in front of our eyes. We don't know if we can trust the people that are around us. Do they have our best interests at heart? How do we make sense of the world? Religion provided a pretty good tool for that. And I'm not sure whether it's possible to be a cultural Christian or a cultural Muslim or a cultural Jew. I wonder how important the belief bit is to the religion bit.
Do you pray?
I meditate, which is as close as you're going to get. What do you mean?
You want to try prayer?
Sure.
Well, I mean, what prayers move you?
I don't know enough. I mean, I took my mum to Ripon Cathedral on Christmas Eve, and we went through a full service of 90 minutes with 13, 14, 15 hymns and a bunch of prayers in between. A lot of Christmas trees and decoration and stuff. But I think that would have been the first time that I would have heard something like that since primary school, since I was 11 or 10.
Yeah. Is there religious music that moves you? See, you have the major scale as the centerpiece of Western music.
Do you need a guitar?
Why, do you have a guitar?
We have a guitar. Can we get the guitar?
Principal reason for bringing out a guitar would be to stop me from singing, which I think is an excellent idea.
Okay, well, hey.
No, but look, I can't sing and I can't play the guitar. I enjoy doing it, so the internet can...
There you go. Well, look, this is a full-size one. Last time we gave you one that made you look like you were a giant.
Okay. So if you just take the major scale, right? That's not really music, but try just the descending major scale. What is that to you?
It sounds like Mary Had a Little Lamb or something similar.
Now what is it?
Where do I know that tune from? What is that?
Joy to the world, the Lord has come. Right now, if you take a different scale, right, and you go, the blues scale. All right, it's a little bit meaner. So you can ask the same question. If I do the descending scale, you know, what is that? It's like the intro from Messing with the Kid. Or it's close to Sunshine of Your Love. Right? So is a descending scale music? Not much, but when it's made music by pausing or by emphasis, one of the great tunes of Western civilization is created, Joy to the World, you know? My feeling about it is that song should move you. And all of these religious songs, they mean something. You know, I was in a car train going from Bulgaria to Kiev, and there were all of these Siberian miners. I brought my harmonica, and they had a transistor radio, and at some point the radio gives out, and they want to drink and dance because this is their holiday. And they started getting really rowdy, and I realized I had the ability to make music. So I pulled a harmonica out. I started playing some blues, and everybody's dancing and having a great time. And they're like, more, minoga, minoga, whatever. And I'm paralyzed. I don't have that much of a repertoire on the harmonica. And the one thing I could do was I start playing Jewish songs. And this woman comes up to me and grabs me by my lapel and says, you know, in Russian, where do you know this from? Where do you, like, I'm realizing that I'm in an anti-Semitic environment, I think. And I've got a Siberian miner who recognizes that I'm playing Jewish music. and I'm terrified. I'm paralyzed. I don't say anything. I pretend that I can't understand her in Russian. And she reaches into her bosom and she pulls out a giant Star of David. Right? And like, she's just looking me in the eyes, like, I know you, you know me. There's a way in which religious music is incredibly powerful, and prayer is incredibly powerful. And I think we're afraid to pray. Do you believe in the devil? You know the song Crossroads by Robert Johnson?
Nope.
Well, I can't.
Let's see if you do.
I don't know that I could do a Robert Johnson version. It would be country blue. But like, if this were an electric guitar, you probably know. Went down to the crossroads, tried to flag myself around. Went down the crossroads, tried to flag myself around. All good people, they just passed me by. He's talking about going to the crossroads to bargain for his soul. He wants to learn how to play the guitar. And that's powerful because you have this myth, you know, the devil goes down to Georgia, or you go to the crossroads to gain something in a Faustian bargain. How are you going to believe that with no Lord? You're going to screw yourself out of the ability to listen to folklore, to mythology, to great literature. And that makes me sad. So we're actually meeting on Shabbat. This is the, I shouldn't have traveled here. We shouldn't be using electronic devices, but I'm not a practicing Jew at that level. But I think about what we say over the wine when we pray, you know? We have this thing where we begin, Vayir vayivokar yom hashishi, vayhul vashamayim vaharetz vekol tzivaam. Like, this is the sound of Jewish prayer, right? And then you're thinking about what it says, and it's very moving to me, because what it is it's taken directly out of Genesis. Vayehi erev, vayehi voker yom hashishi, and it was evening, and it was morning, the sixth day. Right, and Yom is day, and Shishi is six, and Erev is evening, and Boker is morning. So you know what the words mean. And you're actually recapitulating God's shifting from work to rest. So as you come to understand what the words mean, it's not destroyed by knowledge. You know that old song, By the Rivers of Babylon? That's related to the grace that we say after meals. These are references that matter. And I think people are shocked. They don't know how much of their life comes from Scripture. You know, you have a round of firings at a company. Somebody says, I can read the writing on the wall. Well, do you know that that's Daniel 5:25? Do you know what the wall says? I think many, many teku ufarsin, you know, you've been measured and found wanting, your lands will be distributed to the Persians or something like that. You know, these are incredibly powerful references that we live with. You know, you think about the birds. To everything, turn, turn, turn. It's Peter Sears. There is a season and a time and a purpose under heaven. It's Ecclesiastes. You think about Jimi Hendrix going off about two riders were approaching and the wind began to howl. That's Isaiah. Where are you? Where are you with the power of the word? Are you afraid to welcome it in? Are you worried that you'll lose your atheism? Religion is interested in you whether or not you give a shit. It knows about you and it finds its way into every aspect of your life. And if you're going to be an honest atheist, you have to admit that.
I'll go you one better than that. The conclusion that religion is interested in you whether or not you're interested in religion is the same conclusion I arrived at with respect to politics. It certainly speaks to a parallel motive and purpose within both the political and religious realm. But when it comes to the big metaphysical question of existence itself, I fully understand how an eternal existence without a first cause is completely counterintuitive and doesn't even seem logical. But consider the alternative. That's even more illogical, the concept of non-existence, of nothing in the absolute metaphysical sense of the word. You've heard me say it before, there ain't no such thing as nothing, honey, because if there were, wouldn't that be something? Non-existence in the sense of the Supreme Being is a metaphysical impossibility. And I'm beginning to develop a perspective on the idea of first cause and creation that really never occurred to me before, and it seems to conclusively answer the question, why does everything that exists exist? Seriously. And here's the simple answer I'm working on. Are you ready for this? The answer is, because. The word because is composed of two concepts, the concept of being, to be or not to be, and the concept of cause, which involves motion and action. The be precedes the cause. And then it hit me. It is in the being that cause exists. It is not cause that creates the being. All of politics and religion is involved in causes that someone wants to bring into being. And causes are associated with purpose, which in turn requires intelligence. So you can understand why all of these concepts are associated with one another in the order that they are. Now, on the existence of God and atheism, here's how I would frame it. If God is real, then whether or not anyone believes in God is immaterial to God's existence. But either way, in the end, each and every one of us will come to know God. But which of the spellings turns out to be just right, K-N-O-W or N-O, is a prediction that can spin you into a state of infinite regress, along with all the controversies and debates that will never end. Unlike today's broadcast. Now here's what I'd like to know, K-N-O-W, I'd like to know that it will be a yes and not a no, N-O, to your joining us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction, and until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
You know what I was just thinking? Most of the guys that, you know, I broke into the majors with, they're all gone now.
You mean, gone to the great beyond, coach?
Nah, Alan, dead. I can't understand it. You know, you wonder. You're born, you grow up, you die. Is that the end? Is that it?
There's various theories about an afterlife, coach. Millions believe in reincarnation.
You mean like when you come back as a chicken?
Well, not necessarily as a chicken, coach. The Hindus believe that what you come back as depends on your behavior in this life. You know, if you led a good life, you come back in an elevated state.
Like Colorado.
No, coach, more like a king or a prince. Conversely, if you've not led a good life, you come back in a more lowly condition.
Last time out, I must have made a real ass out of myself.
I figure if you're dead, you're dead, and that's what it should be. This idea of living forever doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah, I can see why, Paul.